We're checking in with the City of Milwaukee Health Department here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. In this health crisis and economic recession, how is Milwaukee responding to the inequalities hurting communities of color? What protections are there for vulnerable children in this pandemic and people who work in low-wage essential service jobs? According to new research from the UW-Madison Center on Wisconsin Strategy, people who are being laid off are more likely to be women and more likely to be black and brown. What do you want to ask the city's health commissioner? It's 800-642-1234. Jeanette Kowalik is the commissioner of health for the City of Milwaukee Health Department. Commissioner Kowalik, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good to be back on.
Well, last time we spoke with you, it was April. We were talking about racial disparities in COVID-19 infections and deaths. More Black and Latino residents were dying from COVID. Can you bring us up to date on how you're approaching this issue?
Absolutely. So the Milwaukee County has about 21,000 cases. The city is about 15 or 16,000 of those cases. As far as fatalities, 394 at the county level, 266 belong to the City of Milwaukee. So although our death rate has been low, there's still a number of concerns associated with COVID-19 infection. As far as recovered, that means a whole range of things to different people. Some people have developed new chronic illnesses. And also the ability to expose other people to COVID-19 that may have a hard time fighting off the infection, people that have autoimmune conditions such as myself, fighting cancer, pregnant women, so on and so forth. So we just want to continue to promote prevention by wearing masks, distancing, adequate hygiene, and just limiting congregation as much as possible. But the disparities are still there. We still see the majority of our cases in the City of Milwaukee are Latinx, so that's about 35% of cases. And then for African Americans or Black, it's about 33% of cases. And white is about 17 or 18% of cases. So you can see there's still a disparity in who's getting infected. Even when you look at the maps, you still see most of the cases on the south side, which is where the majority of our Latinx community resides.
Have you done more community outreach, or are you approaching contact tracing in different ways to address this problem?
Sure. So we are working with a variety of community partners. We understand that government isn't always well received due to some of the things our government has done to our communities of color over the years. So it's very important to leverage the power of community-based organizations, federally qualified health centers, and just grassroots initiatives. So just to give you a sense, so we've been working with the 16th Street Community Health Center, Southside Organizing Center, UMOS, you know, it's one of our community testing sites. But just looking for different ways to increase access to masks, outreach, testing, and then access to basic human needs such as groceries and housing and things like that.
So really trying to connect people with resources in their communities so that they are able to stay safe and be able to get the help they need.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned the contact tracing piece. You know, we're looking at innovative ways to be able to connect with people in our community. And we have been able to benefit from internal partnerships within the city, Milwaukee Public Library, some of the Department of Administration folks, and Milwaukee Public School nurses that had helped with contact tracing. But as they're getting ready to phase into reopening, those assignments are shifting. So we're bringing on new staff to fill those roles, of course, making sure we have staff that are able to speak Spanish and other languages for our communities of color. So
you're really seeing, you're going to have to train up pretty quickly here as you see a change out of people on the job of contact tracing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and we understand, too, with this type of work, it does allow for more of a remote or telework type of opportunity. So that might be attractive to some people that maybe are high risk and don't feel comfortable leaving the house, or people that may be retired. We have a number of our retired Milwaukee Health Department nurses that have come back to help us with our COVID-19 response. So just acknowledging them for coming back to help the team during this time of crisis.
We're talking with Milwaukee Health Commissioner Jeanette Kowalik, who is with us to give us a health update from her city. You can join in with your questions. Do you have a child who goes to Milwaukee Public Schools? What are your thoughts about the district's plans? What questions or concerns do you have about children in the classroom? We're at 800-642-1234. Commissioner, the health department released the guidelines and safety checklist earlier this week as many schools prepare to bring students back very soon. What does this checklist entail?
Yes, so that was a labor of love, I would say. A number of school administrators had helped with development of that document, as well as public health staff. And then the NMAC was really, really instrumental. They helped to facilitate a number of conversations. So we were able to get to a point of developing some guidelines or a checklist of how to safely reopen. And that is essentially looking at three different options. So all virtual, hybrid, which is some in person, some virtual, and then in person. So each school should have the ability to move between those different levels of education or instruction due to the circumstances. As of now, if you look at our statistics in the city of Milwaukee and the county, it looks like we're heading in the right direction again. And we can say the mask ordinance has definitely played a part in that, as well as the city of Milwaukee's ability to still issue and maintain orders, and that those orders are tied into school reopening. So right now, schools are required to submit safety plans, and they have to be approved by the health department. It's important for schools to have plans for their individual population, their facilities, because every school is different. So we wanted to honor that. We wanted to look at some of the efforts that had already been made from some of the private and charter schools. And, of course, we've worked very closely with MPS from the beginning. So we have consulted with Dr. Posley and also attended the school board meeting where the plan was up for review.
How do schools handle confirmed or suspected cases?
So right now our concern is the ability for them to be able to detect and pretty much interrupt the chain of transmission for COVID-19. So we have a process where we're looking at schools similar to businesses. The state had issued an update on how do you define an outbreak, and that was essentially two cases for any non-healthcare institution. So we are following that. We're looking at two cases as an official outbreak where a school would have to, depending on where the outbreak is, say if it's in the second grade class or something like that, there would need to be a move back to virtual for a short amount of time while we figure out what the issue is. But every school is supposed to have a COVID coordinator, someone that is monitoring, keeping track of what's happening and working with the health department, so being a liaison to us. And over 3% is when they would have to dial back to virtual. So that's pretty important to distinguish.
We have City of Milwaukee Health Commissioner Jeanette Kowalik with us. Do you have kids who go to Milwaukee Public Schools? What are your thoughts for the district's plans? What concerns, questions do you have about gathering? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Commissioner Kowalik right here on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
here with us for the morning show as we check in with the City of Milwaukee Health Department. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The latest figures out of the State Department of Health Services, Milwaukee County has 21,396 positive COVID-19 cases, 462 deaths. Are you wearing a mask when you're indoors or when you go places? Did you wear a mask while voting? What do you think of the statewide mask mandate? Join in 800-642-1234. And we have City of Milwaukee Health Commissioner Jeanette Kowalik who stays with us. Commissioner Kowalik, we are talking about schools there. And how will you ensure compliance among all the schools with the checklist and with the guidelines on positive or suspected cases?
So this is part of the deal with the plant, is a commitment to ensuring that there's a safe environment for students and staff. So the school administration really has to make sure that they're sticking to the approved plan. If you stick to the plan, there should be very minimal disease transmission, if any, in the school setting. We know that's difficult once the children and staff are outside of the school. If they're going to parties or doing things like that, that's always problematic. So there needs to be some commitment to avoiding certain types of activities to be able to support having some type of in-person school or hybrid type of situation. So that's again, the point of having these plans is part of it is a commitment to making sure that the environment will be safe.
Well, let's take a call. Jack is joining us from Caledonia. Hi, Jack.
How are you today?
I'm doing all right. What is your question?
Good. Well, here's my comment. When this all started, I had a letter from a retired researcher that had studied the coronavirus since 1976. And he said that, you know, it's a cold virus and vitamin D is critical to, you know, preventing coronavirus. My question is, are people of color, since they don't produce vitamin D as readily as a light-skinned person does in the sun, are they taking supplements? Are they taking a vitamin D supplement? Or being informed about this?
Jack, thank you. Commissioner Kowalik, what is known about taking vitamin D?
Well, personally, my physician has instructed me to increase my vitamin D, and this was years ago, and I definitely felt the difference. When you have autoimmune conditions, it's really important to make sure you're doing whatever it takes to try to prevent any flare-ups or setbacks. But the vitamin D discussion, I do see it increasing in our community, and honestly, there are a number of holistic practitioners and groups that are really promoting vitamin D use, of course, under a physician's care, because, you know, too much can always be a problem, so you want to have the right amount. Of course, you also have to have regular labs to see if what the vitamin D levels are. So, you know, again, this is more of a conversation with one's provider on what is an appropriate level for that person considering their health status.
Commissioner,
thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, for sure, for immunity.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Democratic National Convention, which gets underway Monday. Earlier this week, we saw DNC organizers asking attendees to sign a pledge agreeing not to go to bars or restaurants in Milwaukee during the convention. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so that was a part of their app. So they developed this app to really help make sure that everybody is safe and that they're able to kind of keep track of if they develop any symptoms or anything like that. So that pledge is something that was included in the app. So the DNC, the planners, whoever developed the app, they included that pledge as a part of that, and that pledge included that restaurants and bars piece. And I know that's been really prickly. And I was getting a number of requests. The mayor's office was getting a number of requests, and we did not consult them on that. So that was on their own.
What safety measures have you been consulting on when it comes to this convention?
Oh, pretty much everything. I mean, the Milwaukee Health Department has been actively involved in DNC planning since last summer. So we, you know, I've been pulling together a number of partners in the area, the state, other federal agencies. which have been wonderful. I mean, if you ever got to work with the Secret Service, I mean, they're pretty awesome. So, it was very, very organized, streamlined. But of course, once COVID hit, we had to pivot, and we were kind of on a wait and see situation where we didn't know if the DNC would still happen or not. And you know, it's going to be more virtual at this point, which I totally support. But, you know, we're in a pandemic, and there's a convention, and there's a big election that's at stake. So we understand the gravity of the situation, but we have been advising and working closely every step of the way for the last year.
We're talking with Milwaukee Health Commissioner Jeanette Kowalik, who's with us as we get a health update from her city. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Commissioner, I want to turn to the election earlier this week, the second statewide election during the pandemic. How safe do you view in-person voting this time around?
Well, we definitely learned some lessons from the spring election. You know, that situation was very unusual due to the need to collapse or consolidate a number of polling sites down to 5 mega sites. So it was like 170. This time around, we were able to maintain a number of the sites. The reason for the consolidation was due to the lack of poll workers. Poll workers tend to be retirees, people that would be considered high risk for COVID-19. So we didn't want to put those people in harm's way. So we have brought on a number of other election workers. They're trained. They're going to be ready for November. The mask ordinance adherence was on point. And we had a pretty, I mean, the August election obviously was not, I mean, it's much more smaller than, say, like the November election. But I think now that we've been able to test some of the prevention strategies from the CDC, that we can do it. Now, the one concern I have is Wisconsin weather. So depending on how the weather would be in November, if it's a nice day, if it's a snowy day, that's going to impact our ability to maintain the safety precautions. So.
In what way? Because if people are lining up outdoors or they want to get
Absolutely.
Indoors?
Yeah, there's going to be lines. I mean, you know, the November election is going to be busy, but we are encouraging people to do absentee and mailing ballots and all of that as well. But for people that are going to show up in person, we understand that it's important to have public trust and maintain public trust by showing that we were able to really minimize infection in April, considering the circumstances. And then now with this August election that was earlier this week. And then also the CDC highlighted our efforts in Milwaukee. They did an In the Field or Notes from the Field article about Milwaukee, and that is in their publication, MMWR, or is it Morbidity Mortality Weekly Review. So,
well, let's switch to masks now and start off with Steve joining us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, in the retail environment, the managers always tell the employees not to enforce, you know, criminal activity such as stealing because of what could happen. And I just wonder what the guest position is on health departments, such as in Madison, where they're trying to shut down a local coffee shop because they're not having their, you know, $10, $11 employees enforce a policy. Wondering what their position is on that. Is that something that they feel should be enforced by $10 an hour employees?
Steve is asking about how do you enforce the mask mandate, Commissioner?
Well, first of all, I'm all about living wages and essential workers, so they should be getting paid more than that. But as far as enforcement, you should always use your judgment. I mean, you don't want to put yourself into harm's way by getting into an altercation with a patron. So definitely using good judgment. But in the city of Milwaukee, we enforce our mask ordinance, our local mask ordinance, through the businesses. We're not ticketing individuals. At this point in time, we're more so looking at businesses. And the way that it works is pretty much based off of complaints or just observation from Milwaukee Health Department staff. So we're the ones enforcing this, not the police department. And what we do is when we see that there is a violation, we educate the store owner or whoever is there, the manager, If we have a repeated complaint or observation, then that moves into a warning letter, which goes into their file when they want to renew the license for their business. And then if they have another complaint or we have an observation, then they get cited. So it's $500 per day for the violation. So it's three strikes and you're out, just like baseball. We want to be graceful about it, make sure everyone has access to masks.
Have you had to use the three-strike rule on any business?
Yeah. We have issued, I think last week we issued our first one.
Well, so. Commissioner Kowalik, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Milwaukee Health Commissioner Jeanette Kowalik. Coming up, we have analysis from St. Norbert College political scientist Wendy Scattergood and getting your thoughts on presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden picking U.S. Senator Kamala Harris of California as his running mate. What do you think of that? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. With us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're getting your reaction to U.S. Senator Kamala Harris being picked as running mate to presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. They hosted their first campaign event together yesterday in Delaware. Here's Harris.
I devoted my life to making real the words carved in the United States Supreme Court, equal justice under law. And 30 years ago, I stood before a judge for the first time, breathed deep, and uttered the phrase that would truly guide my career and the rest of my career. Kamala Harris for the people.
What is your reaction to Biden's pick? What do you think of Harris being the first Black and South Asian American woman to run on a major political party's ticket? We're at 800-642-1234. Wendy Scattergood is an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Wendy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you make of Biden's pick here? What do you think Harris brings to the ticket?
Well, I think, first of all, it's kind of amazing that we're talking about a Black and South Asian female candidate as being the safe pick, but that's certainly what pretty much all the pundits are saying, that it was kind of a safe pick in that matter. She brings a lot of name recognition. She, very early on in the primary, she was one of the earlier ones to declare her presidency and really took off right from the very beginning. She's won a statewide race in a very large state, very diverse state. So she brings a lot of campaign savvy, a network to be able to do some fundraising. And also, I think, as Joe Biden said himself over and over again, he wanted somebody who he felt like was, as in his words, simpatico with him. And so I think in a lot of ways, it's not that surprising. I think a lot of the people who dig deep into particularly how Democrats pick their VP candidates, that she was one of the ones that was going to be picked.
Yeah, but on the campaign trail, before she dropped out, they were less than simpatico. I mean, they were rivals, and yet, you know, that's what happens when you're vying there on the campaign trail. How do you approach that? What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, I mean, Joe Biden's been in politics for, 48 years? And, I mean, he knows the drill and how this works. He's run for president before. And, you know, that's what a primary season is about. It's to, you've got to, especially when you've got this massive slate of Democratic hopefuls, how are you going to make yourself stand out in those debates that were very chaotic, and you got only a few seconds to try to make yourself shine. And so in that way, I think Joe Biden really gets that, that's just part of how politics in the primary season actually works. And as we saw in his little notes he made to himself, that he doesn't hold grudges. And I think there's a story about them sort of weirdly meeting at an airport during Kamala's husband's birthday party, and they kind of went off and talked about stuff and kind of cleared the air between them. But it's so, yeah.
Wendy, you know, Harris is a former California Attorney General and District Attorney. And as we heard there in her words in the opening, she started cracking up when, you know, she talked about the first time she was in front of a judge. What do you think her legal career brings to the ticket?
Well, I think she's going to have to really make the case to show how she's evolved over time. And I think there's nothing that makes me crazier, and this is a really nonpartisan way, where they're like, oh, she or he changed their positions on this. And, you know, I would hope that we all sort of evolve our ideas over time. And that's something that you do. And, you know, she was known at the beginning. I think one of the early ones that she didn't prosecute for the death penalty when a police officer was killed. But she had come out in her campaign saying that she was opposed to the death penalty, and she kind of followed through on that. And then on the other hand, she...
And this was in 2004, and didn't pursue the death penalty against a man who murdered a San Francisco police officer. Is that right?
Right.
What was the impact of that? I mean, how did police unions look at her after that?
Yeah, I think they were really angry. And I think a lot of people, even some Democrats, not all of them certainly, but kind of felt that was not something that she should have pursued. And then on the other hand, when she was Attorney General of California, there were a number of cases where when there were police shootings, she didn't go after the police officers and try to overturn that qualified immunity. And so I think on the other side, she's got hits from that. So I think there's sort of arguments on both sides about her career, both as a prosecutor in San Francisco and then also as Attorney General of California.
Yeah, I mean, how does that look in the context of the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests we're seeing across the country? How might that history and context affect her and the ticket?
Yeah, it's certainly going to be brought up. And I think, you know, if you are a Republican strategist, you're going to really, really hit on that to make that point. That just sort of, you know, in a rational campaigning sense is what's going to happen. I think there also is a record of her incrementally starting in 2014 after Ferguson, that in California, she starts to try to go after the police a little bit more and talks about making more changes. And so what I think the message that she's got to show and is that over time, she's really tried to make these changes and has evolved in her own thinking, as has the party in general. There is going to be some criticism that she hasn't gone far enough, and that those incremental changes that they're going to argue maybe should have gone faster. And she's really going to have to address that and talk about that evolution and where she is now and just kind of hammer that point of where those policies and Joe Biden too, right, of where, how his policies, particularly after the 1994 crime bill, and he's talked a lot about his own kind of evolution. And I think they are going to have to hit at that hard against criticism that will come both from Republicans and from the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
We're talking with Wendy Scattergood, an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We're getting her analysis on U.S. Senator Kamala Harris joining the Biden ticket and taking your thoughts as well. Do you think Kamala Harris will draw in younger voters or people of color to the Democratic Party? Do you think Harris would make a capable president if she had to step into that role?
What do you think of her track record so far? And as a senator of California, we're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, the news had been so anticipated, Biden was going to make this announcement. And so here we are. But how have Republicans reacted to Biden's VP pick so far? What have you heard?
Well, I think coming directly from the campaign, there was immediately emails being shunted out to their lists. A lot of same things we've been hearing. They call her nasty. They call her phony, a socialist, a radical, that she's soft on crime, that she's going to cause chaos and the downfall of, which is, it's not that new, but I think it really, really ramped up in terms of their social media. They're starting to, after kind of a two-week hiatus in some of the swing states, including Wisconsin, are starting to run ads now. A lot of law and order and economy stuff. But at the same time, I think they're saying, oh, she's soft on crime, and they're trying to hit at some of these other things. Well, she was too hard on some of these other things. And so I think some of the pundits are talking about them, that they're kind of all over the place on them. But I think when you actually look at the emails that are coming from the Pence Trump, official campaign sites, they're pretty, consistent in terms of the words that they're using.
And that consistency you see makes a difference?
Yeah, I think so, because what we know just sort of from psychology is the more that you hear something, the more that you sort of, even if at the beginning you think that, wow, that's completely can't be true, but the more it's repeated, the more you hear it. And these kinds of very short fear tactics, we know our brains are set up to kind of focus on negative more than positive, because threats are bad. And so I think that consistency, particularly with their base, can be effective.
You mentioned campaign ads. What can Harris bring to the ticket as far as fundraising ability?
Yeah, well, I think she's got a national network already set up, and I think that's one of the benefits of presidential nominees picking from among the people who ran in the primaries. And that's pretty common for both parties, is to pick someone who's already sort of set up for that. She's got a lot of social network and online kind of savvy. She's got some pretty avid fans. The hashtag
K-Hive. Is that K-Hive?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and, you know, it's what they sort of call this the stan culture, and that is, you know, really committed fan bases. You know, earlier in the year with the Tulsa Republican meeting, that they were talking about maybe the K-pop fans of kind of snagging up some of those tickets to make it look like they weren't there. And, you know, so that kind of culture is that if she can really ramp up K-Hive, not only to raise money, but as activists, and so that if there is sort of rumors coming out there or to counteract some of these Republican attacks, I mean, she can really mobilize K-Hive to get out and counter that message.
St. Norbert College political scientist Wendy Scattergood is our guide to election 2020 and the Biden-Harris ticket. What do you think about Biden's pick of Kamala Harris? Does Harris on the Democratic ticket sway you in any way? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about Joe Biden choosing Kamala Harris as his running mate. Here is Harris at the podium in Delaware last night, their first campaign event together.
Joe likes to say that character is on the ballot, and it's true. When he saw what happened in Charlottesville 3 years ago today, he knew we were in a battle for the soul of our nation. And together with your help, that's a battle we will win.
What do you make of the Harris pick for Biden's running mate? Do you think she would make a capable president if she were to step into that role? How would you assess her political strengths and weaknesses? We're at 800-642-1234. St. Norbert College political scientist Wendy Scattergood stays with us. So, Wendy, you were talking about how Harris could mobilize her base at times when things may be when she's trying to help control the message. And one of those messages that has already started to go out is where she was born, and that there is this, the Twitter movement of her being foreign born, which isn't true. She was born in Oakland. So what do you make of that and citizenship?
Yeah, I think this goes back to the birther movement with Barack Obama, and it's not surprising there was even some talk of, Tammy Duckworth, that if she had been chosen, that would have become an issue because her mother is Thai, and she lived for a time in Thailand and Indonesia, and there was talk about maybe that was a reason just to kind of avoid some of those birther things. It's not really surprising. I mean, I teach a course on conspiracy theories, and we really are in an era where they've increased massively at this point. We know that there are a number of Republican primary winners who are believers in QAnon. And so it's not really that surprising that we're seeing sort of another birther movement, in particular because Joe Biden is if elected, he would be the oldest president ever elected, and that he's, there's sort of the assumption that he's would be a one-term president, and that, that makes Kamala sort of the heir apparent to the Democratic Party in 2024. And so it's not really surprising that they're kind of starting those conspiracy theories again.
Well, yeah. Can you explain some of the conspiracy theories that you see taking hold as we approach November and in particular QAnon?
Yeah, I think, so QAnon is, a lot of it's pretty vague, but in general, it's kind of looking at Trump being the savior and weeding out some of the people that are within the federal bureaucracy that they claim are trying to sort of take over the country. So I think that will come in, particularly at the election results. I think there will be a lot of conspiracy theories about how the votes are counted. We know that even in 2016, the California vote was late in coming in because they were still counting thousands and thousands of votes, even though the actual Electoral College outcome wasn't really in doubt at that point. And I think we're going to see a lot of conspiracy theories come out toward October and November about different groups trying to subvert the election.
We're talking with Wendy Scattergood, assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We're looking at U.S. Senator Kamala Harris being named the running mate of presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Taking your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Wendy, the VP debate is set for University of Utah on October 7th. It'll run for 90 minutes without commercials. What are you anticipating?
Well, my first thought was, sports is not going to look like it normally looks. Big Ten, Pac-12 are not going to have football. And so I think it's because people are going to really want to watch it. as Maya Rudolph said when she found out about Kamala Harris, she said, spicy. And I think that may be a good word to describe how we might anticipate that debate going.
Because there won't be other maybe sports, controlling our viewing habits at that time, or we won't be shuttling kids out to practice. It may be more center stage.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. We love our sports, and to some extent, debates are about trying to get information about the candidates, but there also is that sort of, sport aspect to it of like car racing and wondering when the crashes are going to happen.
And there's already some speculation as to how she would go up against Vice President Mike Pence. What might be their interactions in a debate?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing is they both are very media savvy. We watched Kamala do well in the primaries, and she got those early big bumps in her favorability ratings after those early debates. But Mike Pence has had a radio show in the 90s and has been governor, so he has a lot of experience. He's not going to kind of back down, or, you know, I don't really expect him to make any big flubs or anything. He may be not as combative as Harris, but it'll be interesting to see how he kind of rises, because we would expect her, and that's kind of what Vice President in the debate between the Veeps, that's kind of what we expect, is the idea is they're the ones that are the attack dogs, so that the presidential campaigns could, in theory, kind of stay more above the fray, kind of act more presidential and diplomatic, but then
take the high ground.
Yeah, and the Veeps get in there and kind of dig in and do that kind of work. So I would expect it to, be spicy.
Let's take a call now. Frederick is joining us. Oh, I'm sorry. Frederick from Duluth is not there. You know, one of the things, Wendy, when you look at age, if elected, Joe Biden will be the oldest first-term president ever. How does Biden's age factor into picking Harris, if at all, as his running mate?
I think it was a factor. I mean, he's talked very openly about his age. He's talked about himself being the transition candidate for the Democratic Party. And so I think that was a huge consideration for him when he was thinking about who he was going to pick, is someone with enough experience. I think his number one thing was qualification, and someone he feel like he could really be a partner in governing with, but at the same time, who could really take the Democratic Party into the future.
A lot of the pandemic has really shifted how campaigns approach events, how they gather people. How do you think that this ticket will be campaigning heading into November?
Yeah, I think social media is going to be huge, and I think that's where having that network, as we talked about before, that Harris brings to the table is going to be really important, because they aren't going to be able to get out there as much. We're not going to be seeing them in public. There's been jokes about, like, oh, man, we're not going to see the candidates eating all the good food. So, which is something that really humanizes and adds weight to, but definitely humanizes the candidates. And I think that's going to be a real challenge, is to you aren't going to see them kind of talking one-on-one. And what's really important about the candidates is not just them getting our message out to us, but you hear in all the memoirs, you hear the presidential candidates talk about how much they love being out on the campaign trail all over the country and meeting people and hearing their stories.
That's where the stories come from.
Exactly. So I think that kind of two-way street part of it, as someone who's just sort of pro-democracy, I'm really saddened by that, because I really see that part of the campaigning of really hearing from people all over the country and hearing their stories. Mm-hmm. We've seen how much that influences presidential and vice presidential candidates, and I'm saddened by that. I hope that there's a way to sort of overcome that.
Well, Wendy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wendy Scattergood is an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Quick note, earlier in the program today, we were talking architecture and Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin in Spring Green. And after the conversation, a representative shared that Taliesin is actually open for tours. Open for tours on Thursdays through Tuesdays. It's closed on Wednesdays. Just ahead, we'll talk with an official from a crisis assistance group in Oregon to find out how the program works and how it got started. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.